Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Brandon Banfield just got convicted of aggravated murder. The jury didn't buy his story, shockingly. They believe the au pair. And now a former federal agent is going to spend the rest of his life in prison. Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, here to break down what happened in that courtroom, what the defense strategy was, why it failed, whether Banfield hurt himself by taking the stand, and the testimony this case, what it brought to the forefront, what it lost. Bob, the jury took 9 hours, came back guilty on everything, no compromises. When you heard the verdict, from your perspective, were you surprised? Did you see this coming based on what we saw at the trial?
To be honest, no. Look, coming out of the state's case in chief, I was a little less confident that they had met their burden. However, like Brendan Banfield was the gift that kept on giving. And I felt once he testified that he really, really helped the state's case. Because, Tony, in this type of situation, when you're talking about a jury who, you know, points that lawyers think are big deals going into a trial, like, oh, we got to drive home this point. Those aren't necessarily the things that always are what jurors are going to hang their hats on. Mm-hmm. But one thing that inevitably is a thing that a juror will hang their hat on is, do I think that this guy is a lying piece of shit? And like that, like at the end of the day, I think ultimately the way that I felt his testimony went is that they were going to pull from that he was a lying piece of shit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and look, it took 9 hours, right? I mean, it was a 9 hour deliberation, which tells me a couple of things, that this wasn't one of those cases. Like we all watch trials, like we're like, oh my God, they're going to like, this thing is like done and done. Like this is like, I don't even know why they went to trial on it. This thing is going to go back there. They're going to pretend like they did something for an hour. They're going to come out and it's going to be guilty. Like, so this, it wasn't a slam the door, we know before we sit down situation. They took 9 hours, but 9 hours to me tells me that this isn't a jury that was torn. There was not a fight that was going on back there. There wasn't a holdout. Mm-hmm. I think what it was is they went back. They said, look, even though the like judges are doing this thing where they're encouraging jurors not to do straw polls when they first get back there, which I hate.
Yeah.
Like, I can see the counter argument as to why you're not going to do a straw poll, which is simply where everybody goes back there. They elect a 4-person and that 4-person says, all right, Let's get a count and see where we're at from the get, just so we know what we're working with, right? And everybody says, okay, guilty. You know, 9 people put up their hands, not guilty, 3.
Yeah.
So that's a straw count. I like those. I think that gives you a good jump off point. But I think probably what happened here is, with even without the benefit of having the results of a straw poll, they probably figured out pretty quickly. We're all of the mindset he's guilty, but let's do the work. And I think that's what they did. I think that they did the work that we always want to see a jury do. Mm-hmm. I hate like a verdict that turns around an hour because you know they didn't go back there and do shit.
Yeah, they walked in knowing what they were going to do right away. Exactly. And the 9 hours, I was like, okay, I agree. Yeah. I feel like they did their due diligence. They gave it time. They had their discussion, and they all came to the same conclusion, it looks like.
That's all you can ask.
When you look at this trial, obviously he lost it, and we'll get into appellate things in a little bit, but I want to talk about just the case itself and how it all went. What do you think how do you think he lost it? What do you think was the move? Was there one move that really made the jury go, yeah, I don't buy this guy? You know, what was there one thing, or was it kind of a culmination of a bunch of, you know, death by a thousand cuts here?
Yeah. I mean, look, if we're looking at it in an intellectually honest way, I mean, you have to consider Giuliana's testimony to be kind of the linchpin. Like, mm-hmm. Without that, I don't think that they even had the ability to bring the case. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? It's like, if you were to pluck her out of it, in spite of the fact that I think that Brendan like sunk his own ship, you know, that is something that didn't have to occur at all because the defense doesn't have to do anything, right?
Yeah.
They have no burden to do anything. So if you pluck her testimony out of that and look at what they would have brought to trial, would that have been enough? I have to say no, it wouldn't have been. So in terms of the importance, I think that her testimony with that sweetheart deal, and there's no denying she got a sweetheart of a deal.
Yeah.
They needed her. I mean, she was the one who could – only the only person in existence truly that could corroborate what the state's theory was. And she went up there and you know, everybody had kind of different opinions on her performance. But at the end of the day, she got out the things that she needed to get out in terms of what the state felt the jury needed to hear. So to me, I thought that she was really the crux of their case.
Yeah. When you have the two of them on the stand, and obviously we did, we had Giuliana and we had Brendan, in terms of credibility, obviously we know what the jury thought at the end of the day, but how did it read to you? Did she feel very credible to you? Did he feel very credible to you? When you're talking about battle of the credibilities here, take the jury's decision out of it. How did you feel they played?
I didn't find her all that credible, but again, mm-hmm. like I know going into any time that I'm watching or observing a trial from behind the bar, as opposed to being in the well of the courtroom, that I am looking at things through the lens in which my brain has been trained to look at them, which is through a defense attorney's perspective, you know, so I can never shake the concept of that sweetheart deal.
Yeah.
You know, like that's what I would have been attacking from the minute I stood up to the minute I sat down, that you can't trust anything that she says because mm-hmm. this deal is that good. You know, like this deal is that good that she is going to get up there and say anything. And in my world, that allows me to give it very little weight. That being said, you know, I think that in my estimation, she's a lot smarter than people were giving her credit for.
Yeah.
You know, like this kind of like doe in the woods, like I don't understand your modern world. English is my second language type shit. I think she was a very calculating person. You know, if you're to believe any of Brendan's testimony in terms of like how she had designs on getting to him with the whole, let's look at all my like the Tinder guys I'm trying to bang. And mm-hmm. wow, they all happen to look like you and they have the same name. Like if that's true, that's some pretty calculated shit. Like
yeah.
In terms of like, I'm coming into this situation where this dude makes a pretty good living. This is a setup that I think that I could deal with for, mm-hmm. you know, an extended period of time. And she makes her moves, and to think that she would have done it in that way. That's a pretty comprehensive plan.
They're both very transaction based. It feels like there's not a lot of emotion. I think that's what I was missing for. I think a lot of people watching this was the emotion of this, the things that were being talked about, it was almost like robots were delivering it.
It really was.
And you're like, what is going on here? Like, how can you talk about your wife or your whatever, like all these different ways without emoting the in any sort of healthy way that others would have, that would have empathy, which I think ultimately goes back to these are probably two people who lack empathy. They're probably, you know, in the narcissistic area and all that. And that's what allows them to operate in the way that they did. At the end of the day here, you get Banfield that goes on the stand. To me, what it felt like two children complaining, you know, telling an adult a story, both of them. It felt like they were telling on each other.
Right.
And each story doesn't quite add up.
Right.
I still feel at the end of the day, we don't know exactly what happened here. I don't think the state's case is 100% accurate. I don't think Banfield's case is 100% accurate. I don't think Juliana's case is 100% accurate. I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. I think Juliana, I think Brenda know exactly where it truly lands, but neither of them are willing to go there or say it. And at the end of the day, the consequences are the consequences.
100%, dude. And I agree. You know, that's a great analogy, because it did feel like, because when you say it like that, it felt like you have your 6 and your 8 year old sat down on the couch trying to figure out which one of them ate the cookies. The cookie jar, after you specifically said no, you can't have any cookies, and they're both pointing the finger at one another, and you're trying to figure out, and none of their stories line up.
Yeah,
you know, so you're kind of left with punishing them both. Right, you're like, you know, and it's like, in here Juliana got away with not really much of anything happening to her, but
and Brendan seems to have a track record here of not understanding that less is more. He's someone who seems to like to add extra details into stories. And that's usually, traditionally can be kind of a sign of guilt if you're getting a little too into the weeds on everything. Yeah. And I feel like he was getting a little too into the weeds on everything, adding little extra details to the story that may or may not be true, but kind of lean into the area of extraordinary. Where he lost me specifically, and I'm curious as to what lost you in his testimony, was wife is stabbed 7 times in the neck, and she's apologizing to him. She's saying, I love you, and I'm sorry. In that moment, she's doing, as she's dying, this is what's going on. Like it's some sort of Lifetime movie, and this is how it ends. Like that may be how it goes on the Lifetime adaptation of this in 6 months. But I don't think that's what actually happened in this lifetime, in that bedroom with that wife. That was the part that got me, and the way he delivered it too. It reeked of not being credible. What was it for you with his testimony that made you go, I don't know about this?
It was the latter. It was definitely his delivery, you know, the weird kind of smirks that kind of creep onto his face when he's saying certain things that just were so misplaced, you know, in terms of the things that are coming out of his mouth. Cause again, like, when you're talking about a witness on the stand, and especially the defendant, any kind of micro expression is going to be looked at by the jurors. And, you know, and I was watching coverage of, you know, some of the folks that we're friends with over at Court TV that were in the courtroom, that were talking about what the jury was doing when he took the stand initially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think it was like Julia Janae was saying, look, when he first took the stand, or it was Kelly, one of the two of them, it matters not, but you know, that they wouldn't even make eye contact with him, that there were certain jurors that he gets on the stand, they're kind of looking up and he's just kind of blathering on. And then when he'd hit a topic that was of interest to them, that is when they would then train their attention to Banfield on the stand. And to me, like that thing that you said were, you know, less is more, you know, like this has to be a well-crafted, well-prepared for direct examination, especially, which I put on the attorney You know, I mean, mm-hmm. if you're going to prep your client for, it's not, and we're not talking about, okay, I've written a script, this is what you're going to say type shit. You're talking about you're sitting with them. You're asking the questions that you intend on asking them, and you see how they answer them in terms of how do they look? What are they saying? Hey, look, you're giving a few too many details there. We don't need to say all that. You're creating some real pitfalls for yourself by going on that. Like, I mean, you give them that kind of advice in terms of like, we want to get the story out and leave as little to chance as possible, because at some point that prosecutor is going to stand up, and the more that you give her to poke holes in, the worse that it is for you. So if you just stick to a very tight explanation of what happened that day and leave all the extraneous stuff out, it's going to be better off for you. And he couldn't do it. I mean, he was that typical fucking Murdoch guy, you know, every defendant that we've seen in recent memory has done the exact same thing. They've mm-hmm. just spoken too much. Because what have there been, like four or five trials? I mean, it seems to be a trend. The defendants are deciding to testify more, and it seems like they all do the same shit.
Yeah. Narcissism is neat, isn't it?
Hey, man.
It always wins. Narcissism will always win, and it will destroy. And not the narcissist, the narcissism. Whoever practices it, the narcissism will win, and that means it will destroy the narcissist.
They can't help themselves.
Exactly. And they seem completely oblivious to how they are appearing. How difficult would it be to be the attorney for Brendan Banfield in this case? Obviously, he doesn't present very well. Yeah. He kind of comes across as a scared, bizarro Charlie Brown character. He kind of reminded me of Peanuts a little bit. The way he was just kind of like precocious, and the eyes, you're exactly right. I noticed he also didn't like looking at the camera. I would catch it a few times where he would catch himself like looking in the direction of the camera as he's doing his notes, and it's like, and then all of a sudden he looks down really dramatic, like, oh shit, I was staring at the camera. Eye contact ain't his thing, and but it also started to make me wonder a little bit. Because there's another possibility. Yes, someone who is lying, you know, through their teeth and doesn't want to be caught, they're going to act that way. You know, folks who also, you know, may be, somewhere on an autism spectrum or somewhere on that scale.
Yeah.
Also, not really great with eye contact, you know, right. Kind of, you know, because I was starting to wonder, is he like a little Asperger here a little bit?
Same thing, dude.
And I mean that. I don't mean that in any sort of negativity. I am. And oops, there goes my pen. And because I'm like, yeah, I mean, he kind of tracks that way too. In which it doesn't always mean guilt. It just means you always feel and look like you're the guilty party. Because I was that kid too that always looked, it didn't do it, but I looked like I did. Right. But he's a grown-ass adult too. But I was wondering that, is this playing out here? But then he started speaking, and then the details kept going and going. And it's like, maybe both are parallel true at the same time. It does, just because you may be there on the spectrum doesn't mean you can't do horrible shit too and then try and lie about it. I feel like all of it might have, you know, culminated in Brendan Banfield.
I agree, man.
I mean, just in a sheer lack of understanding of awareness of around you, of reading your room.
Yeah.
Doesn't have it.
The way that I looked at him, especially kind of to pile on him a bit,
yeah,
in terms of like even the way that he walked, mm-hmm. had that kind of Peanuts type.
Yeah.
He had this weird little like canter to his step. Like when you're watching that McDonald's video, he was like an IRS agent. Like when you think about like an IRS,
I get why he was a good IRS agent.
Right. You know, it's like he had that vibe to him. It's kind of like the way you look at when you watch a forensic pathologist testify, right? Mm-hmm. They're not built like the rest of us because they deal in death for a living. It's a very clinical job that they have. And you know, if you've elected for a career to become an IRS agent where you're basically hunting people down that are cheating on their taxes, it's a very specific thing that you decided you wanted to do. And it really has those connotations of you're a fucking rat.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, so I think you have to be built a certain way. And I think that you have to have a certain personality. You're not going to find a bunch of gregarious, outgoing people that are IRS agents. Yeah. You're going to find guys like this dude.
He was treating it like he was arguing an audit.
Exactly.
I mean, more details. I mean, and even in that, like sometimes don't give more than you need to give because you don't want them to go down roads that you don't want them to go down, or open up things for interpretation that they're going to interpret that may not be accurate. He was fighting it in the way that he seemed to know how to fight things or how he's had things argued to him as an IRS agent. And sometimes it is, you know, more detailed. Here's exactly what it is. And sometimes that adds up. And if you're the IRS agent going, well, okay, well, you got like 40 reasons for this, I guess that is valid. Yeah. Didn't work out that way in the murder case.
No doubt about it, man.
I'm curious to get everybody's thoughts on how he played on the stand, how Juliana played on the stand in the comment section on our Substack or on YouTube. Please do weigh in, hiddenkillers.substack.com. The link is in the description. Brendan Banfield's going to prison for life. That's what the jury decided, but his lawyers are definitely going to appeal. It's just what you do when you're facing life without parole. The question is whether any of it actually matters. Bob Mata, defense attorney, with us to help break down what Banfield's team may be going to argue. We're only a day after the verdict came in. Sentencing still has yet to take place. But Bob, let's just kind of cut through the legal stuff. When someone gets convicted of aggravated murder in Virginia, what does life without parole actually mean? And is there any scenario where Banfield doesn't die in prison?
I mean, short of him winning his appeal and getting a second trial, no, because in Virginia, life means exactly that. Life. There's no parole board review. There's no good behavior. There's no statutory kind of mechanism to reduce the sentence. It's like when you get life, it's exactly what he's going to do.
Other than, and we'll get to it, other than procedural missteps where they can, you know, argue this or that, or some T wasn't crossed or I wasn't dotted, was there anything in the actual case in chief, anything that stands out to you that was argued or wasn't argued, that should have been argued, that was excluded, that stands out, that could be possible grounds that an appellate court will look at and go, yeah, you know what? Let's go back. I think you get it. You deserve another shot at this.
I mean, I didn't see anything, but to be fair, in terms of some of the pretrial proceedings that happened with respect to evidentiary stuff that mm-hmm. probably was argued, I didn't look at it super closely. I mean, typically, you know, most things when it boils down to like objections over, you know, like your standard objections that you're hearing all the time, like relevance and, you know, all those different types of objections are never going to amount more than harmless error. So in order to get something overturned, there's going to have to be some significant evidentiary issues that arose either pre-trial or that may have happened during trial, such as where if there was an offer of proof about something that was going to be testified to, that the appellate court could be swayed to think, all right, like that really hurt in terms mm-hmm. of this guy getting a fair trial. The jury should not have heard that. And had they not heard that we don't think that there was enough evidence for them to have reached the same conclusion in terms of guilty or not guilty. So, I mean, they'll certainly look at evidentiary rulings. You know, the digital forensic stuff is interesting. You know, I mean, there was quite a fight about that. You know, could there be Brady material? Theoretically, there could be.
Theoretically, yeah. I mean, I guess and we'll get to the forensic, the material that we were just talking about there, the data on the FetLife site, who was looking at it when. But first, let's talk about Juliana for a second, because that was a big thing. I mean, and it was, you know, a big gamble. It was something that I think the defense was looking at and hoping the jury would see.
okay, look at this. She got a sweetheart deal. She's going to go back to her country. She's getting time served. And she pulled the trigger. And she's admitting to being someone who pulled the trigger. If that's not a sweetheart deal, I don't know what is. But in reality, yes, it's a sweetheart deal, but it's a pretty common deal. It's a pretty normal deal that people make all the time, that prosecutors make all the time with witnesses. Somebody who's bad, we're going to let them go for the sake of getting someone who's even worse, essentially, is kind of seemingly the way that they looked at it. Is there any ground there? Is there any lever that they can pull in appeals in regards to Juliana's testimony and the fact that she does have that deal that, okay, you testified, you did your part, now you get your ticket back to your country? It certainly looks coercive control, but again, this is a normal lever that's pulled. This was nothing really that out of the ordinary.
Yeah, let me put it this way. If they go into the appeal and that's their primary issue that they're going to try to hang their hat on, he's screwed. Yeah, I mean, it is almost impossible to get a conviction overturned solely because there was a cooperating witness that got a favorable deal. Because as you said, that happens all the time.
Yeah.
They call it turning state's evidence for a reason, because people do it all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you get co-conspirators or co-defendants and they flip. I mean, it's a primary resource for the state to get convictions, where they've got a witness who they know is going to have warts because they were a part of the shenanigans. But they also know that that person has details that no one else is going to have.
Yeah.
You know, so for them, in terms of weighing the pros and the cons, and with her, like you said, they really don't know what they're going to get in terms of, like, how is she going to perform? I mean, we all heard her 911 calls. I think we would all agree that whatever the fuck those were terrible.
Yeah.
You know, like, those things were a hot mess. Like, I don't know. Like, she just failed completely. And whatever her role was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they talk that through, assuming that what the state's theory is somewhere in the world of being correct. Cause I agree with you. There is no black and white in here. Everything falls in the grays. It's some version of that went down, but, like, you know, the details, which we'll never know, you know, unless Banfield's narcissistic ego just makes him want to write a book. How I almost got away with it. You know,
exactly. I don't know what the Son of Sam laws are there, but anything's possible. Let's talk about the digitals for a second. The searches, the FetLife searches, all of that. Initially going in, this was a big thing the defense was kind of hanging their hat on, saying, see, the cops, their own investigators don't agree with the prosecution. And, you know, in theory and in some lanes, that is true. I mean, they did get rid of the digital forensic investigator. The detective said, you're never going to do this again, because they disagreed so much with the findings, because the findings from that person that was doing that don't match what the prosecution was selling. Was that explained well enough to satisfy you when they were on the stand? Because I was wondering about that too, going, this is weird that they're in this much disagreement. But then they explained it on the stand, and I don't know, I could see why one, if you're overseeing someone who's doing the investigation and they're coming to this conclusion, why one would go, your conclusion sucks, because there's all these other possibilities here that show how this is possible. You're really looking at it with blinders, and I think they might have been really looking at it with blinders at the end of the day. And once it got this kind of parsed out in the courtroom, we saw it for what it was, and apparently the jury did too. But again, it's a big piece of this. How did that read to you personally as a defense attorney, and does that hold any ground if it were to go to an appeal?
I thought they missed the mark, and I'm talking about the defense in terms of kind of driving that home, because that, frankly, to me, was some of the most powerful testimony that you could have had in your favor, where you've got kind of warring factions within law enforcement themselves, you know, so much so to the extent that they're pulling people, lead investigators, off the case.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's kind of the way to introduce the concept of tunnel vision to the jury. And you know, I just think that they really kind of missed the opportunity with respect to that, in terms of really fleshing it out way more heavily than they did. And, you know, if I'm appellate counsel, that's where I'm living. Right there. And look, I mean, the defense needs to prove it. Like when you're talking about, you know, was there potential Brady material? Because there's a big difference in whether something smells wrong and whether something that you can actually demonstrate was wrong to an appellate court, you know? And so, and it's a tough thing. You know, it's like that thing Allison and I always talk about it. I'm like, you rarely hear about cops and or prosecutors getting jammed up and like, why aren't they getting in trouble? It's because it's almost impossible for a defense attorney who has no access to any of the shit that they do or say or write behind the scenes in their offices to where we're going to get the evidence that we would need to actually prove it. You know, so that's a real, like a really uphill battle. It's like we're stuck, much like prosecutors are in most cases, with circumstantial evidence. And, you know, the government typically gets the benefit of the doubt. Like, oh, no, they're the white hats. You know, we trust them. Like everyone wants to believe that prosecutors and cops don't lie and cheat in order to get convictions, you know, and like it's kind of like we need that to be true in order for this thing to not be a total nightmare. And I'm talking about the justice system. I mean, we have to hope that a bulk of the people doing those jobs are honest brokers. Right. But we all know that that's just not the case. There are certainly going to be bad people in those positions. Like there are in any job on the planet, you know, but it's still, that being said, proving it to the extent where an appellate court's going to say, yeah, we agree with you here, is a really, really difficult task. But in terms of kind of the stuff that I think that the appellate lawyers are going to have to kind of really focus on that I think might have legs, that's where I'd be living, man.
Yeah, and the thing is, with a case like this, just because something with the investigation didn't go great or you have infighting in the investigation doesn't mean anything was necessarily going on that was nefarious. You can just have people who aren't doing their jobs well. That just are coming to bad conclusions. And a superior is saying, no, you're wrong. Your conclusion is wrong. You're never going to do this again. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're trying to hide that conclusion because it's inaccurate. It just may be this person doesn't have the reps in to really know what the hell they're talking about to come to that conclusion. And I feel like that's kind of what happened in this case. At first it was weird. And then it's like, oh, well, they only looked at it at this angle. Right. And I feel like a lot of that was parsed out. But again, an appellate court can take a look at that on the same evidence and go, yeah, okay. Yeah. I don't think you got a story here. One more on this, you know, is there any world in which he can go after Jay Peterman, the attorney? Because I was asking people the other day, like, who does he reminds me of somebody? And the suggestion was Jay Peterman from Seinfeld. He kind of looks like him. Didn't talk like him, but kind of looked like Jay Peterman. It would have been great if he delivered everything like it was a catalog entry. But is there any world where he can look back, where Brennan can look at his attorney and say, ineffective assistance of counsel, especially with the fact that he testified, you know, or is that, nope, dude, at the end of the day, it was your choice if you wanted to go up there on the stand, and you did. No one was forcing you. Just because your attorney said, yeah, go for it. Yeah, it's his job to do, you know, he's working for you. Is there any world where ineffective assistance of counsel rises to any sort of culpability here?
No, I mean, not on direct appeal. You know, the direct appeal, I doubt that it'll even be raised. That's going to have to be in post-conviction petition world, you know, because IAC claims are tough. You know, I mean, in terms of proving ineffective assistance counsel, you first have to show that the attorney's performance fell below. It's like a malpractice case with doctors. You know, first you have to show that the performance of either the surgeon or, in this case, an attorney fell below the objective standard of reasonableness. So you're going to look at it. Okay. Like, I'm not comparing it to the greatest fucking attorney of all time. Like, that's not the bar. It's just kind of what's reasonable. Like what would a middle of the road attorney, what would that attorney have done? And does the performance of this particular attorney fall below that? The concept of Banfield testifying is a non-starter. That's fucking his decision.
Yeah.
All an attorney can do is give advice. Like, I think it's a bad idea, buddy. You know, and Banzo's like, well, too bad. Like, I got to tell my story, bro. I got to tell my story. Like, nobody stopped me. I'm telling my story. You know, so like whatever conversations took place between those two. And then you have the additional burden with that particular scenario of privilege. You know, it's like the attorney's not going to be talking about what was discussed between attorney and client with respect to that decision being made and what was said between the parties in terms of it landing with Banfield taking the stand. So that thing is a non-starter, but you know, so you've got that issue. Did the performance fall below an objective standard of reasonableness? And then second, you have to show that there was prejudice, you know, and that there's a reasonable probability that resulted from this lawyer's terrible performance that prejudiced the defendant in such a way that he didn't get a fair trial because his lawyer was so bad. And it's just, it's tough, man. Like everything typically gets pushed into a strategic decision pile by the appellate courts or on post conviction, you know, cause a lot of it is, you know, it's like, it's easy to sit back in Monday morning quarterback what lawyers do and don't do during a trial, you know, cause like when you're in the arena as an attorney, you know, you're really trying your very best, assuming that you're a prepared attorney that actually gives a shit about doing their job properly. You're going in. There's always going to be things that you miss. There is no such thing as a perfect trial. And that goes for the state. That goes for the defense. Sure. That goes for law enforcement. For everybody involved. We're all human beings. Mistakes will be made. And, you know, it's like when you look at it, like, you know, it's like the Supreme Court once said about pornography, like, and it was one of the great quotes of all time from one of the justices who said, you know, like, I can't describe pornography, but I know it when I see it.
Yeah.
And it goes the same thing with IAC. You can't really, there is no definition of it, but if you watch it and you see it happening, you fucking know it when you see it. Like, when somebody's so bad, you're like, oh my God. Like, this guy just, or this gal is just absolutely not prepared. And it is affecting this dude's ability to get a fair trial. Like, you know it because it's so evident. If it's anything that's going to kind of fall on the wayside, like I said, of a strategy decision, like, well, gee, why didn't they call this type of expert? Right. Mm-hmm. Or like, why didn't they cross-examine this witness more aggressively? You know, it's like, those are things that you have to think about as an attorney when you have a witness that you know is going to be damaging to your client in terms of what they're going to be testifying about. Strategically, you're not going in just shooting from the hip. Like, if I had a witness that I knew that was going to be really, really damaging to my client, the discussion with my other attorneys on my team that would be trying the case with me is, how do we approach this? Okay, she's a woman. Do I want to be the fucking bully, jag-off male attorney that's bullying this woman on the stand? Or do I want to take it from a more casual approach because I'm trying to chip away at her credibility as opposed to going in with a hammer and trying to break her apart? You know, and ultimately, whichever way we lean on in terms of a team saying, like, we think you got to go at her hard, and if that backfires, that's not ineffective assistance of counsel. It was a poor strategic call in the moment, you know, and you never know. You know what I'm saying? So
you know, the perception and the optics are everything at the end of the day. And and you got to work with what the tools you've been given, and what a tool Brendan Banfield was. the biggest question I know everyone is asking out there right now, and I think the ladies who've been watching this are probably salivating a little bit, and they're going, oh my gosh, this is a single man. He's going to be on the the convict dating site soon. How long do you think until the women of America can get a chance to be the next Miss Banfield?
you kid, but you don't, because believe me, you and I both know there's gals out there that'll be knocking at his door.
I know. That's the sad part. That's sad, scary part. But I'm going to guess, knowing this guy's track record, he's going to be on those. I guess probably one of his first questions is like, okay, like, how do I get money into the canteen and how do I get on the convict dating site?
100%.
It's going to be right there for him.
100%.
Your thoughts in the comment section on this case. What do you guys think about his appeal chances? Anything stand out to you? Let us know on Substack. The link is in the description or on our YouTube comments. Again, the link in the description. Let's go over to the Tepe case. Michael McKee is charged with murdering his ex-wife and her husband. The evidence looks very bad. You have surveillance footage, allegedly, a vehicle traced back to him, witnesses saying Monique told them he'd threatened her for years. This is not a case that I think you want to be on the Michael McKee side of. This is going to be a hard one for anyone to defend. Bob Mata, defense attorney, is here with us to break this down. And I'm going to make you put on that defense attorney cap. And I'm sure you've probably already been running this through your mind a little bit. I mean, the man looks guilty as sin. But he, you know, someone's got to defend him. He's hired a very high profile, a very successful defense attorney to back him up. Bob, knowing what you know about this case thus far, and this thing came across your desk, what's the first things going through your mind?
Oh, boy.
Oh, pass? You're going to someone else.
Well, I mean, look, if you get a case like that, look, the bottom line is the job is that you want to make sure that the Constitution's being protected. But sure. it stands like, and I know it seems like kind of a generic, like, oh, but it's so true. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, the thing that we have to concern ourselves with is make sure that the Constitution is protected, make sure that the guy gets a fair trial, make sure that the cops and the prosecutors do their job on the up and up so that we can feel comfortable with the actual verdict. And this thing, if it ends up going to trial, I have a feeling I will not be shocked, T, if we're talking about, you know, my honest opinion of this thing. Like I will not be shocked if he pleads at some point. There's just like every case isn't going to go to trial.
No.
You know what I mean? And most cases, a vast majority of cases do not go to trial, you know, but let's pretend that there's a world in which Michael McKee is a giant narcissistic fucking weirdo, which he is, you know,
allegedly. So like, yes.
So in that world, I can see this guy being like, I don't think they have much. I want to go to trial. Cause much like we talked about testimony in terms of a defendant being explicitly that defendant's choice, same with going to trial or not going to trial. A lawyer can give you all kinds of advice, but at the end of the day, that decision is wholly sitting with the defendant. They are the one who gets to decide. Like I've had cases where my clients are like, I'm like, it's, you know, we're in trouble here. You know, they've got a lot of powerful evidence. And, you know, I think it would behoove us to try to see if we could work out an agreement where maybe I can shave some time off your sentence. And again, remember, everything's not murders, right? So, you know, so like in this particular case, you're always butting up against the concept of, I believe there's a moratorium on the death penalty out there.
There is,
So, I mean, depending on what happens with that thing, because moratoriums can be lifted.
Yeah.
But if they're making a stone cold, fuck you, you're going away for the rest of your life. We're not budging on that. You're not getting an offer other than you can just spare the families of having to sit through the trial. If you have a grain of decency that flows through your body anywhere, which is a tough sell to a narcissistic psychopath, right? Like they're not going to be like, oh, you know, you're right.
I think about it from a humanistic side, they don't have that. Yeah,
exactly. So like if we're living in that world, which I think we could be, and you're trying to look at it from a defensive, like you're going to have to attack. It's a circumstantial case, right? But it's a very powerful circumstance. Most cases are circumstantial. In most cases where they have a lot of powerful circumstantial evidence, a lot of times to me, in terms of if you've got direct evidence in terms of an eyewitness, I'd pick to have the circumstantial, the powerful circumstantial case where it is that thing where Occam's razor really does apply. Like, I'm not one of those people that thinks that everything's Occam's razor. Mm-hmm. There are prosecutors out there I know that think that everything's Occam's razor, you know, which is, the most obvious thing is the correct answer. So, which can be true, but like we were talking about, there's a lot of shit in the grays.
There's a lot of obvious things in this case.
There is a lot.
If just one of them is true, it's pretty damning.
Exactly.
And I guess you got to look at it like, well, what does he have to lose? I mean, if death is already off the table because, and we don't know, because they could try and do a death penalty case, even though there is a moratorium, it could be lifted at some point. But let's just say it's not a death penalty case. What does he have to lose other than money, other than paying an attorney? And then you have your freedom if you win and whatever money you have left. If you lose, you're in prison for the rest of your life. Those are your options.
That's
why
exactly
not fight?
Point.
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean,
and
I guess that's where, you know, you take a look at it, and I wouldn't be surprised if he pleads either. But to someone like this, it feels like there's a lot of Coburgery vibes going on here to me, where it's a game, it feels like, and you can't catch me. And even though it's really obvious, I'm going to say I was staring at the stars for 3 years until the 11th hour that I'm finally going to go, yep, I did it. Nothing more, but yep, I did it. I could see that being the case. Not necessarily because he wants to give any sort of, like, you know, thing to the family or any sort of grace. But it's because it inconveniences him. He's sick of going back and forth from the courthouse. He got that ride. He's been doing it enough, and he's fulfilled. And he doesn't like people looking at them and saying, you're wrong. Because it would be humiliating. And you know, narcissists don't like humiliation. They 100%. Don't like being disrespected. And a trial would be 1,000% disrespect to someone like this. And that's like kryptonite. But until then, you know, drag everybody through the mud, drag them through your hell. I wouldn't be surprised if he does just that. The prosecution is leading hard in the surveillance footage, the car coming and going, him allegedly walking through their yard weeks earlier. You know, it sounds horrible when we hear these headlines. How, and it's from the prosecution, how reliable are these claims when they're saying these sort of things? I would imagine, you know, there has to be some strong credence on it if they're going to be throwing it out there the way they are.
Yeah, no, I'm going to assume that, you know, the things are as they say they are with respect to the evidence that they collected. I think that they'll probably be able to prove it up. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, ultimately, with any surveillance, you know, we all saw what they released to the public in terms of the dude walking down the alley. You can't really see his face. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you could talk about his build and things of that nature, and maybe have, you know, some kind of expert come in and say, okay, well, you know, like, we've been able to work it out that this guy's, you know, because McKee's kind of a big dude.
Yeah.
Right? He's kind of a hulking figure. So, you know, I mean, you're not going to be able to ID him in terms of saying, well, I could see his face clear as day, so that's definitely him. You know, the vehicle stuff's pretty powerful. I mean, it's clear that he's there.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, like, I don't think that they're going to have any problem getting a jury to buy the fact that this creep was there.
Yeah.
No, what they're going to put out there in terms of forensic evidence in the house is going to be important. Mm-hmm. You know, like, what are they able to find? You know, obviously we know they find the silencer, you know, and like, mm-hmm. I can't remember if it was in our chat or where the fuck it was. Like, people are like, oh, you know, like, silencers don't prove shit. Like, that doesn't bring. I'm like, you know, 700,000 people own silencers. That's our Second Amendment. I'm like, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
That's it. It proves shit. And, you know,
the average gun owner doesn't have a silencer. You know, I mean, they don't. I mean, if you're a super enthusiast and you collect a bunch of shit and you just spend your money on that, okay, maybe. But if you only have so many weapons and you have a silencer and it happens to be connected to the murder weapon itself, that's not a good look.
It's not a good look. I mean, when you happen to be the guy that they're accusing of murder,
yeah,
you probably don't, like, if you're one of those Americans that's screaming about your Second Amendment rights to own a silencer. Yeah. If you get the sense that law enforcement is going to be looking at you for murder anytime in the near future, you might want to lose that thing. Because I'm telling you, it's not a good look.
I mean, in some states, they're illegal. I know that. I mean, is this really a state? I don't know the answer to this. I don't know if you do either. But is it? I thought it was illegal to even own a damn silencer. Maybe that's just a state thing.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a state by state thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, because, look, I mean, there's a lot there's a lot of excuses of people why they might want a silencer that are not very compelling to me in terms of why.
You're out hunting like a hitman for deer.
That's what it seems like. I know. Right? I mean, that's like kind of the first thing that pops in your head. Well, this guy's probably a hitman. You know, it's like try to keep that shit on the down low. You know, because like I think it was in our chat from our chat last week.
Yeah.
That where somebody was making the comment like, oh, that there are hunters that use them on their rifles. I'm like, okay, I did not know that.
I didn't either.
You know, I guess that's a thing.
Okay.
I'm not sure. You know, I mean, maybe the point of that is if like you fire your first shot with a rifle and if you've got the sound suppressor on it, that it's not going to spook the deer in the event that you miss the first shot. Mm-hmm. So that the deer will, I don't know. I don't know.
Maybe that's the thing. I don't know. I mean, I grew up in Wisconsin amongst hunters and I'd never have heard or seen of one using a silencer on their, but again, this was the 80s and 90s. Maybe things have changed. I don't know. I'm not up on the culture. So I could easily be wrong. I don't know the answer to that.
What I do know the answer to before we move on is that, again, if you're being accused of being a double murderer, and they find a silencer somewhere in your possession, and there's nobody around the area that is claiming to have heard gunshots, it's not a good look. You might want to get rid of that thing. That I know.
One more. Why do you think he kept the gun?
I have no idea. You know, it's like, again, the only thing that you can think is his fucking ego and his narcissism. And he's just like, they're not going to catch me.
I got two things. I mean, I got that. I agree on that. I think there's a level of that that's at play here, but I also don't think he was done. I feel like this guy might have been going on the Michael McKee grievance tour, and this was stop number one. And thank God the tour was canceled before it went further, because there was other people. You know, there was the civil suits. There was this. I wouldn't have been surprised if that gun was kind of his little security blanket and he was going to be out, you know, making some more stops on other folks who've wronged Michael McKee. Considering how he disappeared from the planet from so many people, I don't know. That means pure conjecture. Who the hell knows? Digital is going to be really interesting in terms of the footprint, not only for the murders of the McKee or for the Tepes, but I'm really curious if they're going to find more on the other folks that he had grievances with. And I'd be curious if there may be other charges that could come out of that. If it shows that maybe there was some premeditation or planning for other folks too.
Yeah. Other people that he's already done it to.
That would be even more interesting.
Yeah. I mean, like I can't, we talked about this last time. I mean, like there's a lot of similarities to my client, Anthony Garcia. Like I said, when they nailed him going down to Louisiana, they were dead set on the fact that he was going down to kill the professor that fired him most recently from his residency there. So, and he might have been.
It's an odd modality at nearly 40 that you're just suddenly murdering people. And if you've always kind of been this angry, narcissistic, you know, self-loathing, you know, individual, which it appears, you know, that's kind of how he was, you know, allegedly, in my opinion. It would be odd that suddenly this is what finally tripped you up to make you go that far. I wouldn't be surprised if there was other folks in the past. I'd be looking very closely at anyone within the realm of his, you know, reach over the last 20 years that died.
100%. In any kind of mysterious or questionable way.
Yeah.
You know, because like this guy, as we find out, as more and more information kind of drips out, and when the new, you know, the new version of the probable cause affidavit dropped and we found out some of these facts. I mean, this guy, like we learned that it wasn't just this petition that resurfaced. Like this dude could not let it go, you know, and like
for a decade.
And he's sitting there at their fucking property in the early December, lurking and creeping. You know, it's not some kind of coincidence that she's leaving, Monique's leaving the fucking, the, you know, early in the second half of the Indiana-Ohio championship, like Big Ten championship game, which is a big deal. They're both Ohio State alums, you know, they're like, they're with friends. It's like, and she's dipping out to the hotel. This guy's, in my world, clearly sending pictures like, I'm outside your house.
There's something. There's,
You know what I mean?
The like ring camera. Or can you imagine her sitting there at the game and you get the little chime and you're like, oh, did UPS drop something off? Oh, it's just my ex-husband who's threatened to murder me. And so there he is. Yeah. I mean, it's what a horror story.
Just what a horror story. Like terrifying. Yeah. It just shows. It's like that thing that we were talking about last week. That like a piece of paper doesn't do shit.
No.
Like if somebody's got designs on doing something unthinkable like this, like you've got to do as many proactive things as you can in order to defend yourself, because you have to assume the worst.
You do. You can't just rely. That piece of paper is not going to do shit. And it's not. And don't anybody take that as don't report it.
Right.
Report it. Report the shit out of it, because that will help you. But those are building blocks that you need should it escalate, which obviously this escalated. But, you know, you at the end of the day, the cops are not your, they're not the Kevin Costner and you're not Whitney Houston.
Exactly.
You know, they're not your bodyguards. And yeah, you can call them and they will do the best they can. But keep in mind, there's a gazillion other people they're protecting too. And unless you're going to hire 24/7 security, you better have some means ready to go when Nutcase shows up at your doorstep. And who knows, maybe they did. I mean, you get ambushed in the middle of the night. It doesn't matter if they, who knows? I don't know if they had guns. I don't know what they had in place, but if he had a way in and there he is with a gun and it's to your head and you're sleeping, you're kind of fucked.
You're fucked.
And yeah, and if he doesn't care about getting caught, which I don't know, I mean, the sloppiness of this, it appears he, you know, tried to be elusive, but just wasn't very good at it. If they don't care, yeah, that's even worse. That means there's nothing that's really going to stop them unless you happen to strike first.
I mean, when they're coming at you. Yeah, I was just going to point out that comment, T. So that's
Monique had more
not
gun
surprising, shipments. Yeah. Sadly, you know,
that's horrible.
That tracks. Yeah. It, like when kind of the factual scenario comes out of how the two victims are found and where they are they in bed? Are they, you know, out of bed? Yeah. All that stuff. Like if this guy just crept in and, you know, does this while they're both sleeping, what a fucking, like, what a coward. First and foremost, and what an awful, awful piece of shit.
He is the stuff of nightmares. If
it really
he
is.
Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube, or join our Substack. Check it out. The link's in the description. HiddenKillers.substack.com to join us over there. And hey, press subscribe on our podcast wherever it is you get podcasts, Apple Podcasts, iHeart, Spotify. Take us with you. We put about 8 to 10 episodes out every single day.
A lot of content.
On the cases that you all are following with expert interviews like Bob here and our commentaries. If you like what we're doing, search us up wherever you get your podcasts and press subscribe. We do appreciate that greatly. We'll continue the conversation in the comment section on YouTube and Substack. Until then, for Todd and Bob, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Every dating app swap is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Every dating app swap is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino, it's a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made, because that's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Every dating app swap is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.